You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahia hi mare e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toka ingoa.
Ko Sophia toku ingoa, nau mai, haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. We are like scrambling around the studio to get our shit together right now.
I know, I forgot my headphones.
Oh no.
I'm over myself.
I'm in like my post-hosting breakfast. Breakfast? Breakfast chaos. Oh, it's been a morning, but I'm glad to be here.
That's okay. We've got this.
We've got a stacked show today. If I can name coming up on the show, what have we got, Maya?
I had a korero with Tui Dipros about their current show of rituals on At Room. So what do you have?
I had a korero with Tarika Sabol about her current show at Season Aotearoa, A Lag. I also caught up with Emily Hartley Scudder about Unerased, Made in Palestine, a fundraiser exhibition opening tonight in Ponsonby. And I spoke to Ruth Cleland about her current exhibition at Suma Concrete.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces, so tuku patahi mai. You can text us on 5395 5395 5395, or wai mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koa e wareware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō hei pakiheri rokiroki maronga i te paitokutoku o Irirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
What's it all for?
Various Artists.
A Lag is Tarika Sabol's first solo exhibition at Season Aotearoa. The title itself has a double meaning, by which it can be read as either A Lag, as in the Hindi word for separate, apart, parted or different, or A Lag, as in a lag in communication or a glitch in some sort of system. The images are drawn from Hindi iconography, continuing a theme in Sabol's practice of exploring and reimagining well-known motifs, as seen in paintings of horses and felines, for example. The works show a continuation of a side of Sabol's practice, which uses an airbrush tool to paint onto raw canvas, creating a dyed effect and bold contrast. I had a korero with Tarika about her practice and A Lag.
I sort of find ways to narrativize my personal relationships and political landscapes within a South Asian mythological framework.
Mm.
And my practice is really materially driven, so I'm specifically interested in how unprimed canvas retains information and knowledge. So I use additive and redactive processes of making. So I'll be sometimes dyeing the canvas and maybe scrubbing off the paint, and I sometimes deconstruct the canvas as well. I think for me it's like the idea of removing information, making it harder to read the image, interfering with the legibility that you encounter. I'm interested in like storytelling in general. I grew up in India and I moved to Aotearoa when I was 11 years old with my family. So I've grown up with a lot of Indian folklore, and I'm interested in how the folklore, how it's shaped and read or misread and translated, sometimes mistranslated, and how it's remembered and used to construct narratives. Because I noticed when I was growing up that stories can change even ever so slightly depending on who's telling the story and even who's listening. And in my practice, I'm trying to question and depart from extremist ideologies and sentiments formalized within our South Asian community. And then I do this by showing alternate ways of encountering a certain folklore. So I might reinterpret it and I might reject some aspects, cherry pick, and extend on some aspects of the myth. I'm really drawn to like the repetition in the culture and the symbols. Yeah, that's a bit about my practice.
I wanted to start the conversation about this exhibition specifically with talking about the title itself. It's got a bit of a double meaning. Are you able to speak to this and how this has thematically informed this body of work?
Yeah, so I was actually thinking about words or phrases that have dual meanings in Hindi and English. And sometimes meanings can be lost in translation, and, you know, or with like a mispronunciation comes miscommunication. And I'm quite interested in that aspect. I was thinking about a phrase or a word that could be like, that could be read in both English and Hindi, but still add to the body of work, even with a possible mispronunciation. So alag can be read, can be interpreted in Hindi as apart or parted, different. It has a couple of different meanings in different contexts. And it can also be read as alag. And I was thinking, because my work lives in a very fantastical, futuristic, digital realm, I was thinking about like a glitch or a lag in communication, using this miscommunication or mispronunciation to actually aid the work and add to the context of the work.
Yeah, and I wanted to come back to, you know, what you were talking about before, talking about those kind of key interests that influence your practice. The works, like the majority of your practice, are influenced by Hindu iconography and folklore, and explore the ways in which these can be reimagined. In this show, you're further experimenting these reimaginations with cats and horses. Can you speak a bit more as to where you find inspiration and how that translates into the work, particularly with this body of work and those two symbols?
Yeah, I think it's, well, I want to draw more from the culture, so repeated symbols in maybe visual scriptures or like, sort of tales with morals in them instead of directly drawing from the religion. And these horses, they always felt like this symbol of freedom to me. And these cats are like cheeky, fun, playful beings. And, you know, this body of work feels like it quite silent, but quite jarring at the same time. Yeah, I just wanted to bend on sort of these winged horses that I've seen in visual representations, and they might be, they're not really main characters, they're quite like on the side, but they have, all of these characters have tails to them. So I just wanted to find ways to connect and extend on these symbols, really.
Yeah, with the show is also a continuation of a side of your practice which uses an airbrush tool to paint onto raw canvas. Can you talk us through what that process exactly looks like for you, particularly in comparison to other painting or sculptural styles you've employed in your practice before?
Yeah, the airbrush, I've been using it for a couple of years now, actually. I use it in a way where it's just on raw canvas, it's more stainy. It is like a lo-fi device, which I quite like. And I think this show in particular, I was able to create this very collagey effect, which was quite fun, like this repeating image just stacked on each other. Yeah, and so with this show, actually, I've been airbrushing and then scrubbing off a lot of the areas to reveal the raw canvas. I try not to use the color white or black too much because it does get quite murky using the airbrush very quickly, and then it just the aesthetic for me, I feel like the staining feels quite right, especially depicting these images. That's basically how I use the airbrush, is add a little bit on and then I scrub most of it off.
And you've been talking quite a bit about this idea of repetition, particularly with this show. And it is something that I particularly notice, is this idea of kind of mirroring and each work maybe echoing with each other. And I'm thinking particularly about like the collection of the four cats in a diagonal line and the horse works that feel like they kind of communicate with each other in the space. When creating a body of work, is the ultimate cohesion of the works in an exhibition sense a big consideration for you?
So when I'm creating the work, I think I started just thinking about containing these symbols within a space. And I think when I first started, I had a lot more animals, but I wanted to keep it quite particular with the horse. I think the horse has been drawing me in quite a bit. Like this, I'm painting some statues, so I'll like chop and paste them, and they feel like they have this false sense of freedom. Almost they look like they're moving, but they're quite rigid and stiff, and they're silent, they're blind, but they're following each other in a certain direction. I feel like there's a tension, but they still kind of communicate with each other quite effortlessly in a way. I feel like this is a start to my inquiry into blind cultural obedience. I was just trying to think about how storytelling changes with each teller and listener. So I was thinking about these symbols of freedom contained and stretched within the space. I just wanted to add a little bit about like the part of my practice that I'm at right now.
Yeah, no, please.
Which is, I feel like at the moment I'm still world building and still archiving symbols from these myths. And this is this idea that the body of work is quite far from the original depiction, but still carrying some essence of the original one. So I guess just back to your question, I am extending on these images, and I want to be able to allow people to carry on their own interpretation of the work, an extension of these old tales and these symbols that might not be seen quite often or have ever been. I mean, there is like the Pegasus, but like the Indian version of like the flying horse, maybe not many people have seen.
That was artist Tara Kasabawal speaking to me about her current solo exhibition at Season Alag. Alag is on until the 12th of July.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is PJ Harvey.
I'm walking in the city tonight. I'm walking in the city at dark. Remember light. Thinking nothing in the shooting stars. And this world tonight is mine. A world to be remembered in. Ever been. The sky lit up. The sky, my friend. The sky lit up. And I'm lighter than I ever been. I saw the trees crossing the moon. I saw the stars in the heaven above. Shine on my own beautiful prayer. Shine on my own beautiful Lord. The sky.
Darling, but is it art?
Tui Diprose is a queer interdisciplinary artist and body worker of holistic healing. In a coming together of knowledge, they engage within an artistic practice that centres in jewellery, installation and writing through an exploration of themes of place, environmentalism and decolonisation. Diprose's current exhibition, Rituals, at Room weaves together an array of artistic techniques and materials. Silver, sapphire, bone, harakeke, clay gather within the show to create a symphony of material dialogue. The works within the show are created within a space of ritual, between a bridging of the physical and metaphysical worlds, with the spirit world alive. The rituals of Diprose's create a practice that translates to a show that welcomes audiences into a space of ritual, as well as a welcoming into the act of ritual itself. I had a chat with Tui about the show. I started off by asking Tui to speak to their overall practice, their use of mediums, as well as their key themes. Here it is now.
Kia ora, ko Tui toku ingoa. I am Tangata Tiriti from Tāmaki Makaurau. I am an interdisciplinary artist working in jewellery, installation, writing, and I'm a body worker of holistic healing. My creative practice centres in jewellery. I work across a wide array of materials that are usually found, foraged or gifted to me. My favourite materials are stone, clay, harakeke and tikoka. In the rituals exhibition, I work with silver, stone, plants, ceramics, wood, video installation, and a small book of poems. Key themes that run through my practice are place, environmentalism, animism, decolonization, dreams, and ritual. And beneath these wider themes, I contemplate and creatively draw through thoughts of the Anthropocene, death, grief, and healing.
Beautiful. Your current show, Rituals at Room, showcases these methods of creating within ritual, resulting in a show that really transforms the gallery space into a place of ritual itself. Can you speak a bit more to this idea of ritual, both in relation to its thematic navigation within the body of work, as well as what it means for you to create within ritual?
I find that ritual as a way of being helps me create deeper meaning in my day-to-day from small rituals such as lighting a candle or larger rituals that are in tune with the Maramataka moon phases and take hours, days, weeks or longer to move through. The body of work in rituals is a compilation of jewellery made over the past few years, created across journeys as I moved and lived in various places throughout the Motu, way down in the Otago region, then up to Northland. The silver hairpins, called Rivers of Time, were made during rituals where I engaged in the Akashic Records, which is a place beyond time involving the soul's journey through many lifetimes on Earth, often known as past life regression. In this ritual space, I was channeling a previous lifetime or an aspect of my soul that helped me create in the present. Leading up to the rituals exhibition, I stepped into a month-long ritual where I was in Wānanga the whole time, meaning I was communing with the spirit world very deeply, up making at the witch's hour, losing complete track of time, or writing before I'd left bed in the morning. It was immersive and took me into some deep places, both within myself and as a healing ritual for the collective within my making. Within this body of work, I engage in tikanga and rongoā Māori due to the immediacy of connection to my surroundings here in Aotearoa, which grounds me into this earthen reality and helps create structure for my making practice as I follow the tikanga of tapu and noa when making. My rituals involve working with the spiritual kaitiaki of the whenua, the soul of the natural world, the atua, my spirit guides, along with the Māori of the materials themselves.
And you briefly touched on this, but this body of work, you engage with an array of mediums, your pieces acting as these anchors of material form as you create amongst a bridge of worlds. With the spirit world alive, you navigate through materials of silver, sapphire, bone, harakeke, clay, and many more. They gather within the show to create a symphony of material dialogue. Can you talk to me through your use of these materials and the specific techniques that you use with them, and why you are specifically drawn to these materials and techniques?
Often the materials themselves will find me, or they'll jump out at me, calling and asking to be worked with. Sometimes it's an embodied tug, turning my head to look specifically at a material. It catches my eye and seems to be more vivid than anything else. Sometimes I simply see it in my inner eye or mind's eye, the material that I need to work with, presenting itself to me over and over again until I pay attention and use it. If I'm outside, the tree or plant will communicate with me, asking to be incorporated into my work. Everything is symbolic, yet also has its own innate sacred modi, and the materials will communicate this as I work. This is often the way with many jewelers or makers who choose to work with a specific material, that the material speaks to them and shows them how they want to shift forms through the maker. For example, the necklace titled Talisman for Seeds, made of black clay, harakeke and kauri gum, references both the darkness of deep earth and deep space. Carrying a weight when worn acts as an embodiment aid for those who slip beyond their bodies too often, gently drawing their attention back to the body as the sensation of the necklace is felt. On plant fibres, tikoka has a connection to spiritual sovereignty. Harakeke symbolises whānau. These feature in the work Talisman 3 Light Codes and are material manifestations for calling in new souls to the planet, to be born on the planet, who carry new frequencies, representing the soul in its lightest aspect, anchoring in healing codes of the sun and the life-giving nature of photosynthesis.
Beautiful. Accompanying the physical works within the show, you also have a booklet of writings on offer. Could you speak to me a little bit about the text itself, as well as its inclusion in the show, and the dialogue and kind of relationships it has with the other works in the room?
The booklet of writings was one of the works made during my month-long ritual leading up to this show. It was mostly streams of consciousness, bringing subconscious thoughts and feelings to words that would simply arrive and find themselves there on my page. The intention was to create writings that would accompany the artworks, but I found myself journeying through my interior worlds differently than I initially anticipated, resulting in a work of itself. What was arising was the written processing of thoughts and emotions lurking in my subconscious, drawn out during the quiet of night, relating to my journey and my making journey over the past few years, living in the mountains close to the land, of supporting loved ones through pregnancies, miscarriages, birthing babies, of loss, both collective and personal, of buried grief, processing the death of loved ones, which, as we draw close to Matariki, they were coming to the forefront of my mind and writing. There's also environmental grief, the Anthropocene, wars on the planet, and being an embodied soul, meaning the ways which I find myself more at ease in nature than anywhere else, where I have my poems devoted to an embodiment of nature itself, such as the words like becoming rivers, becoming the mountain, where I release ego and attachment to being human and become nature, which is also my making process and how I create my jewellery talismans. That relationship reveals itself through the choice of materials I use, that being ones I find in my environment on walks out in nature, ones that I hunt down for specific purposes, or those as gifts.
Beautiful. I think it's such a wonderful part of the show that really is something that you can take home with you, which I think is really lovely. The show really welcomes audiences into an act of participation and encounter, with multiple points within the show becoming a site for people to engage within ritual, inviting them into a facilitated ritual in which there are kind of instructions or actions for them to engage with. Could you talk a little bit about these invitations of ritual that you are inviting audiences to participate in, as well as your overall hopes for viewers as they navigate the show?
The intention here was to create pauses for viewers to become part of the art if they wished. the rituals allow them space to gather their thoughts and put them on paper, as in the writing ritual where you're asked to write a love poem to your body. This was to give a moment of embodied self-awareness, guiding the viewer back to self as they navigate the space. It's a little confronting to be suddenly self-aware and contemplating one's own body, hence the need to anchor in aroha. The water rituals in the ceramic vessels that I made are based on Dr. Masaru Emoto's theory that the molecular crystal structure within water can be affected and changed through our thought forms, meaning the vibration of our thoughts can facilitate change. Water is featured largely in the rituals exhibition, rivers being both the muse of creative endlessness, sites throughout the motu that I connected into as spiritual anchors, along with our human bodies and the earth's body being mostly composed of water, which feels very significant to me. If we can transform the crystalline structure of water through our intentions, and water is a conduit for energy, then I will carry the water in the rituals exhibition shared here back to a larger body of water to then amplify the energetic intentions, carrying them even further into the collective consciousness for healing. Ultimately, the entire exhibition of rituals then becomes a healing space for personal and collective transformation.
That was Tui Dipro speaking to me about their current exhibition, Rituals, on Now at Room until the 5th of July.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
Gorgeous. We'll be right back.
Check out the coolest exhibition at New Zealand Maritime Museum, Hui Te Ananui a Tangaroa, Into Ocean and Ice. Go on a polar journey to Antarctica and experience five artists' interpretations of the fragile beauty of this epic landscape. From Ernest Shackleton's heroic expeditions to the climate-threatened island of South Georgia. Into Ocean and Ice. On now until August 31st, 2025. Free entry with museum admission. For more info, go to maritimemuseum.co.nz.
You come across an obstacle. Do you climb over it? Do you tunnel under it? Or do you go through it?
Find out the best way to forge ahead at MOTAT School Holiday Experience. Over and under, explore bridges, tunnels, burrows, and more.
Learn how to build your own structures using constructible kits, foam wedges, and arts and crafts. Plus, discover natural, animal-made, and man-made tunnels across Aotearoa.
Over and under at MOTAT, these school holidays, included in general admission. Go to motat.nz for more.
Bon appetit, 95BFM listeners. We've just brewed up a combo of hot tunes and cold beers.
That's right. Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside is back, Friday, June 27. Come hang out, have a cold one, and watch some live performances by two iconic bands. Voom and Cindy. 95BFM Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside, Friday, June 27, from 4 till 7pm. With thanks to McLeod's Brewery, the Beer Spot, and New Zealand On Air.
Oh, that's a good art.
Anurace, Made in Palestine, is an exhibition by Pornicke-based artist Emily Hartley Scudder, illustrator, maker and activist Pinky Fang, and multidisciplinary artist Nathan Tare, opening tonight at 250 Ponsonby Road. The exhibition began with Pinky's mother discovering a collection of imported vintage cosmetics at an estate sale in the Hawke's Bay, of which a variety of beauty products, deodorant, hair oil, baby powder, toothpaste and more were labelled Made in Palestine. Notably, the products are all from pre-1948, and a number of the brands are most likely European Zionist manufacturers who had immigrated to Palestine before rebranding their labelling to Made in Israel in 1948. Each product has been photographed, centering the Palestine label as an assertion of its ongoing existence that many still try to erase and refuse to officially recognize. To accompany, Nathan Tare has created a limited edition attar fragrance with notes of olive leaf and watermelon, which stands in stark contrast to many luxury perfume brands with entrenched Israeli interests. And Pinky Fang has made an accompanying pocket-sized beauty boycott zine to distribute, drawing attention to the corporate conglomerates on the boycott list who are parent companies of so many everyday toiletries. All proceeds from the exhibition go towards convoys of good for families in Gaza. I had a korero with Emily Hartley Scudder about the making of Unarrays Made in Palestine and the exhibition's kaupapa. So Unerase, made in Palestine, started with a collection of imported vintage cosmetics that Pinky Fang's mother found at an estate sale in the Hawke's Bay, with each product labelled made in Palestine and notably from pre-1948, before the Nakba. Do you want to firstly speak a bit more as to how this project came about?
Yeah, kia ora. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. So myself and my friend Pinky, we're both artists and obviously have, you know, been really paying attention to what's happening in Palestine and, you know, really struggling with knowing what to do. And she, her mum, collects vintage objects, furniture, all sorts, and has been for a number of years. And Pinky was going through some of her stuff, and they found that some cosmetics that Pinky's mum Sue had bought in the 70s actually had made in Palestine on them.
Wow.
Palestine was their point of origin. And she was like, gosh, this is just such a, you know, fascinating thing to stumble upon. And she actually thought of me because I'm an artist who works with objects, cosmetics. I kind of do still lives and paintings and installations, but it's often around things to do with the body and kind of particularly around the bathroom and things like that for quite a while. So it was kind of perfect that we found these, and we kind of wanted to work out how we could, what we could do with them. And I thought just photographing them, getting in really close kind of with the macro lens and making these like a kind of really quite fun series of photos with almost referencing kind of commercial product photography with kind of droplets and colours and, you know, spilt makeup and powder and stuff in the background. Yeah, so that's kind of how it started. And then we wanted to form an exhibition and then also have the actual original objects on display as well.
I wanted to talk about this role of art and activism, because art has long played a strong role in activism, and artists have been instrumental in raising awareness to a cause or questioning the status quo and provoking thought and reconsideration. For you as an artist, where do you see your role in this, particularly with this exhibition? Or why do you think art is so great for provoking and continuing such important korero?
I guess we have a responsibility to kind of do what we can. And I guess the great thing about being an artist is that, like, you choose what you want to make your artwork about in some ways. And while it can be quite hard to shoehorn particular things into a practice, and it doesn't, not all art does have to be political, but if it doesn't really quite fit with what your practice does is exploring, I think it's important to actually just kind of get out there yourself and spread the word and go to protests and whatnot. And if you do have some kind of a platform because of your practice, it's kind of using that to share, to spread the word and share awareness and kind of keep people talking about Palestine in this case. For me, this was just kind of in a bit of a moment where the stars aligned, because it actually kind of fits in with my larger practice at the same time. So it was really amazing for this to kind of come together with Pinky and just realize, like, oh, I can actually kind of use some of my skills as an artist and, you know, some of the things that I know about organizing events, putting on exhibitions, and actually do that as part of it, and to raise money as well. So we're selling photographs, and we also have a beauty boycott zine that Pinky's developed. So it's like a pocket-sized zine, and it basically draws your attention to all of the toiletries and everyday products that should be boycotted because they have the links to Israeli interests and making money that goes towards, you know, the Israeli government, and basically that's obviously not a good thing. So we're kind of using that, using these products, that these vintage products that we found as a starting point, and then kind of bringing that into the contemporary, and, you know, making people really think about what products they use. And actually another really special component of the show is we've also collaborated with Nathan Tade, who is a just wonderful artist who actually makes works with scents and makes perfumes and all sorts of smelly things as for artworks, but also for sale. And he's made a really, really special attar fragrance, which is a really pure perfume oil in a Middle Eastern kind of style. And we'll also be selling those. And he's actually titled it Samud, which is actually a word for Palestinian kind of resistance. And yeah, that's like a really wonderful component as well, as kind of this like resistance and activist, but that we can kind of come at it with in quite a different way than you usually would, which is nice. Yeah.
Totally. And I did want to speak to each of those elements a little bit more. With the photographs, you kind of touched on it a bit earlier, but they've each been photographed so beautifully with this clear focus on the product itself. But I wanted to ask about how the photographs have been placed, how the products have been placed for photographing. Some of them are seen with the fishnet pattern of the kefir, others with a velvet backdrop and other patterns. Can you tell me a bit more about those choices?
Yeah, so I have a whole collection of different coloured paper and different kind of fake tiles and textures and whatnot in my studio, and was kind of perfect for creating these backdrops, because I often take photographs of kind of objects for often to make paintings from, but kind of perfect for these objects too. So what I did, I really like just kind of doing everything in camera where I can, and so I kind of chose these backgrounds, and it was wonderful to be able to bring in the kefir pattern as well. So it's all very lo-fi. I literally kind of arrange them on a tabletop, and I actually have layers of perspex that I kind of prop up at different levels so I can play around with the depth of field, and then I've shot them from above, but I've kind of carefully propped the object so some of them look like they're kind of coming forward at you, and that's created by that kind of layering. And so I've been able to have a lot of fun with that really shallow depth of field, and kind of have these objects almost floating and in this kind of otherworldly way. So so that was a really fun way to experiment, and just really capturing that label that says, you know, produce of Palestine, or made in Palestine, which is fantastic. And actually for this show I've actually taken 12 new photographs, because we did do this exhibition, a version of it last year in Wellington, in Te Whanganui o Tara, which was wonderful. But we wanted to build on it as well. So, it was so lucky during the last exhibition, we just so happened to uncover more of these objects when Pinky got access to her father's, I think it was his boat shed, that had all of this other stuff that was had been hidden away.
Wow.
And she actually managed to find like an original olive oil tin, which is obviously super special because of being the home of the olive. So that's a new photograph in the show that I think people are going to love, and that has the kefir in the background. And I think it's really interesting just thinking about these objects, that a lot of them, they would have changed their labelling to made in Israel after 1948. And there's kind of a mix of brands. Some of them were, tried to do some research, some of them were European kind of Zionist manufacturers that kind of immigrated to Palestine and kind of started industry there. But obviously it was Palestine, so they were still using that on their labelling. And I think it was really fascinating to just really think about, I guess, the capitalist dimensions of, you know, of Palestine and, or, you know, of colonisation, and kind of how industry and all of that really does contribute to like colonial projects, and how that kind of links to places like Aotearoa as well, kind of, you know, going to a place and kind of seeing all these resources, and then working out how they can, you know, use them, take them, and creating their new kind of colonial version of what they want to create. So I think it's, you know, they're kind of these beautiful photographs on the surface, but then, yeah, I think the existence of these products have you really thinking about, have you thinking about kind of colonization, and they were imported to shop in Hastings in the 1930s, and we actually managed to find a ad that the shop put in the Hawke's Bay Tribune at the time, and it said Palestine is the land of milk and honey, and Palestine means quality. So we thought that was a really interesting component as well, this kind of like land that's rich in resources. And then how that also links to Aotearoa, because that's kind of also a term that we learnt in high school, or potentially around how Aotearoa was this land, you know, land of milk and honey, with all of these resources to be kind of tapped into, and how that was kind of synonymous with, you know, the colonisation of Aotearoa. So, yeah, I think there's some interesting conversations to be had, but also hopefully some beautiful photographs, and also like this amazing attar perfume oil, this kind of fighting resistance perfume that people can smell.
Totally. And I think that really nicely leads on to my last question, just to kind of sum up our korero. This exhibition offers up this collection of artifacts to spark and prolong dialogue around Palestine's history and Israel's ongoing war in Gaza. And this, of course, is for a very important kaupapa, and all proceeds from the fundraiser go towards Convoys of Good for Families in Gaza. Ultimately, how do you hope viewers engage with and respond to the show?
I just really love them to, to look at what we've made, but also really think about what's going on. And maybe this is a way to talk about it. It's a kind of a different way in, because obviously it's so awful what's happening. And sometimes it's just so hard to even comprehend. So in some ways, hopefully this is potentially maybe some sort of something that can be a bit uplifting, perhaps. People can show their support and buy a photograph or buy a fragrance. That money will go towards Convoys of Good, which is a fairly new New Zealand registered charity, but it works, it works to get money for food for families in Gaza. So I think it's nice that people can maybe take some things away as well, and maybe bring some artworks into their home that kind of represent how they feel about the world as well. So so it actually opens this Friday, so that will be tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. at 250 Ponsonby Road. The show is just on for 2 weeks, so, you know, limited time. So it's on from the 28th of June to the 12th of July, and the hours were open Wednesday to Sunday, 12 to 6 p.m. And there's an online store that's live as well. You can find it through kind of my Instagram, and that we'll be taking print orders and selling the perfume for the 2 weeks. And there's also a floor talk with myself and art historian Liz Eastman this Sunday, the 29th at 3 p.m. And we just kind of chat about the project, but also talk about how censorship is often quite a large problem when it comes to art projects and talking about Palestine and just kind of the crazy things that that have happened with censorship, but also, you know, what we can try and do as artists and, being in this art community that holds itself up as being people who can make a difference, but also, you know, can always work harder, for sure.
That was artist Emily Hartley Scudder speaking to me about Unerase Made in Palestine, a fundraiser exhibition opening tonight from 6 till 8 p.m. at 250 Ponsonby Road.
Hi, I'm Veronica Huber. I'm an artist, and you're listening to BFM.
Concrete is Ruth Clellan's second solo exhibition of new and previously unexhibited works currently on at Suma Gallery. Clelland is known for her photorealistic depictions of everyday subjects and scenes, with this exhibition exploring concrete flooring and locations and sites she regularly encounters. This body of work shows a subtle but significant development in Clelland's practice, whereby more emphasis has been placed on the interrelationship between her gridded paintings and photorealistic concrete floor depictions, and how they respond to one another. As in previous works, this exhibition continues Clelland's sustained inquiry into image and grid of subject, time, and value as she traverses the hyperreal and abstract. The works are more than representations of concrete, but a collection representative of equanimity, eliciting a state of quietude within the viewer. I had a kōrero with Ruth about concrete, as well as her practice and process more generally. This exhibition, Concrete, is showing a subtle but significant development in your practice, namely in the increasing clarity with which the grid articulates its relationship to the final drawing in a collection of diptychs. How did this kind of development of your practice come about for you?
Yeah, so the grid has always been present in my work. It sort of underlies all of the photorealist pieces that I make. The grid method is a traditional method of mapping and transferring and enlarging images. It's been used for centuries, and it's the process that I use for all of my photorealist work. And over time, the grid has become more prominent in my practice. I've long had an interest between the relationship of the photorealist and minimalist abstraction genres. Visually, they're really compatible, in my opinion. They both emerged around the same time in the 60s and 70s as a reaction against abstract expressionism. And to me, that sort of preciseness and formality of each of those modes of working works well together. And so I've been playing around with combining them and placing them alongside each other for quite some time. And the grid has become a major component of the abstract work, I guess because it has always been a part of the photorealist work. So in previous work, I've often placed panels alongside each other, the photorealist work with a grid work next to it. The grid works have kind of, I've played around with them sort of potentially imitating surfaces or being really like sort of close-up views of something. The idea that they could be abstract or they could be a real depiction of something. And likewise, the photorealist work often plays with becoming quite abstract, that really close-up look of thing, close-up view of something with all the periphery removed. It becomes sort of a flat plane of marks and scuffs, light reflections, that becomes quite abstract. And so there's this shift between the abstract and the photorealist that I've been playing with for a while. And this particular show is kind of, like you said, the grid works have a much closer relationship to the photorealist works. Each photorealist work depicts a concrete surface, as the title of the show suggests, and each photorealist work has an abstract work responding to it. So I've looked at the geometries of the concrete floor, the composition that I've used, and I've broken that down and reinterpreted it as a grid work.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about site with this exhibition. As a viewer, you initially think that this body of work might be site responsive, as the works of polished concrete flooring strongly resemble the floors of Suma's gallery space. One or two of the works are responding to that space, but other works are not depictions of the space, and rather they're consciously site unspecific and locationally unimportant. What interests you about creating a work that is transferable in these different spaces and locationally ambiguous?
Yes, the way that I kind of choose what I'm going to, the sort of spaces that I'm going to work with, they're generally local to me, and I guess that's sort of for a purely practical reason. I don't drive, and I want to be able to take my own photographs and work from those. So they're all local. They're spaces that are for the most part, transitional. They're not spaces that you kind of spend too much time in. You sort of go for a particular purpose and then you leave again. Two of the works in the show are of the gallery floor. They were taken, well, they were captured right at the very beginning as the gallery was being constructed. So it was sort of in a transitional state. The sort of plaster powder smears and spots all over the floor. Two of the works are of a local supermarket floor in the local supermarket that I've actually been using as a subject for almost 10 years now, on and off. So that's a site that I have returned to a number of times. And the other floor that I've concrete surface that I've depicted is a concrete footpath right outside my front porch. So that's very local. And I guess, yeah, it's just sort of what I've kind of come across over my sort of day to day, what I've sort of found and over time, and yeah, what I've found interesting. And as you sort of mentioned, the locations themselves aren't particularly important as far as the viewer is concerned. I don't identify where these spaces are in the works themselves. The spaces are at very close-up views. I've removed all the periphery or any details that might identify where the space is, because it's ultimately, it's about the surface itself and looking at those details, and the location isn't important. And really, because the surfaces are so everyday, like ordinary functional surfaces, they have a familiarity to them. They're so utilitarian that they could be anywhere. So yeah, the specific locations are not important, yeah, with these works.
We were touching on it earlier, but your work has long been noted for its hyperrealism and precision. Do you feel like you're quite mathematical in your process?
Yeah, it is quite mathematical, and in the sense that, well, as I've said, that I use the grid as part of my process to map out all the detail, and really that is the only way of making sense of it, because there's no real logic to the pattern. It's quite chaotic with these concrete surfaces in particular, and so I do have quite a formal and precise way of working in order to kind of make sense of it. So it is a very methodical way of working and a very time-consuming exercise. Yeah,
I can imagine.
It's a slow process, slow development over time, where I sort of started off with the suburban scenes, and then it's moved to the shopping malls and the traffic islands and the parking buildings, and then it's kind of ended up with this supermarket space that has been, although it's only two works in this show, that has been a subject that I've returned to time and time again, and it's really kind of focused me in on the floor. It kind of interests me because it is literally sort of looking down and then elevating the subject up onto the wall, which I guess is a way of, you know, it's like elevating something that would normally not be paid attention to. It's also kind of a documentation of, because I've sort of spent so long in this particular location, it's become sort of a documentation of how the space has changed as well. I had a show a few years ago called Terrazzo, and it was the Terrazzo floors in the same space, which have since been removed and replaced with this concrete floor, which features in the show that's currently on. So it's kind of it's kind of almost like an archive of a supermarket floor, which is quite kind of funny. I guess the other thing that I haven't really talked about is the role of the photograph. I mean, I guess it's the whole thing of photorealism, is that the works are not of the surface itself, they're of the photograph of the surface. So it kind of takes on all these characteristics of the photograph that you wouldn't get just by looking at the floor in reality, the way the light hits the lens or the distortions that happen through the different translations of the images into the different formats. I guess ultimately it's about slowing down and spending time looking at the details, and about creating a quiet focus and sustained attention to the little things, to the things that would not normally be considered important.
That was artist Ruth Clellan speaking to me about her show currently on at Suma Gallery Concrete on until the 12th of July.
Various artists.
All right, we'll be right on back to give you your arts guide. This is Fontaines DC, Televised Mind.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings and that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tāmaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, Anurei's Made in Palestine opens tonight at 250 Ponsonby Road from 6 till 8pm. The show runs for another 2 weeks after that.
Also as mentioned on the show, Rituals, an exhibition by Tui Dipros, is on at Room until the 5th of July.
A Log by Tarika Sabawal is on at Season Gallery until the 12th of July.
And Concrete by Ruth Cleland is on at Suma Gallery until the 12th of July.
Also on at Season Gallery is Inflation by Gerard Dombrowski on until the 12th of July.
Welsh artist Sarah Thwyn Evans is currently showing at Michael Lett Gallery until the 12th of July.
Everything on the 12th of July.
Yes.
Tala Oleto, an exhibition by Angela Tiatia and Yuki Kihara, is on at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 30th of August.
Now I'm a Wall, Now a Window is an exhibition by Saskia Leek on now at Ivan Anthony until the 19th of July.
And Differences in Kind and Rhythm is an exhibition by Peter Robinson and Italian painter Giorgio Griffa on now at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery until the 24th of August. If you have something you want on the art guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on Various Artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Tarika Sabawal.
Tui Diprose.
Ruth Cleland. And Emily Hartley Scudder. Nei rā, hoki te mihi, kia koutou, e whakaroa ana, thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com.
Ka hoki mai mātou, Aotearoa Wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Mari. My name is Sophia.
And I'm Maya.
And that was Various Artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.